From KQED and NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Scott Schaefer. Republicans have had a strong, surprising, and shocking night.
Democrats are shocked, too. I'm Ray Suarez.
We're still waiting for results in several key states. But right now, Donald Trump, the GOP nominee, is leading the Electoral College 264 to 218.
Hillary Clinton's path to the White House, considered likely just hours ago, has rapidly fallen apart.
We're trying to figure out how that happened as we wait for final results from the few remaining toss-up states.
We're watching Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and New Hampshire, which are all leaning toward Trump.
The good news for Democrats? Well, there hasn't been much good news for Democrats. They captured a Senate seat in Illinois, held on to a seat in Nevada.
But their chances of flipping the chamber? Nearly impossible.
Stay with us for details.
And we begin our coverage this hour with NPR's Domenico Montanaro. And, no one saw this coming except you, Domenico, right?
Nope. I will say that. I'm not sure that I can speak to a whole lot of what I do know about politics anymore, because data was so off. I try not to shoot from the hip. I try to let the data speak, and everyone got it wrong, privately and publicly. Private polling for the campaigns, public polling was way off, and this is your result. I mean, there was an outside chance that this was a possibility early on. You know, if Trump's populist message could resonate in the Midwest, that, you know, he could win in what I was calling in a trade win scenario, where he could win a Wisconsin or a Michigan or a Pennsylvania or some kind combination. Never really thought that it could be this high a level, especially when the polling was showing something different. I will also say that since you started at the top, the Associated Press has now called one electoral vote for Donald Trump in Maine, that congressional district in Maine, the kind of rural district where Bangor, Maine is one of the larger districts east of the Mississippi. And, you know, you have Paula Page, who's the governor in that state. You've had a lot of people who feel disaffected from the system, who don't trust the elites, who don't trust Washington, and they wanted to send a message, and apparently they did tonight. Trump is at 265, Clinton's at 218, so Donald Trump needs one more state to put him over the top.
Domenico, for months, the narrative that formed around this election was that if you took the states won by Barack Obama and the last several Democratic nominees going all the way back to Bill Clinton's run in 1992, you had pretty much two-thirds, even more, of the way to 270. And it was the consensus among pollsters that Hillary Clinton was most of the way there. Mm-hmm. How were so many so wrong about so many places?
That's a great question, and we're going to see.
Actually, Domenico, I'm going to interrupt you right now because John Podesta is speaking at the Clinton campaign party celebration tonight in New York. Let's listen.
I want every person in this hall to know, and I want every person across the country who supported Hillary to know, that your voices and your enthusiasm means so much to her and to Tim and to all of us. We are so proud of you. And we are so proud of her. She's done an amazing job, and she is not done yet. So thank you for being with her. She has always been with you. I have to say this tonight. Good night. We will be back. We'll have more to say. Let's get those votes counted, and let's bring this home. Thank you so much for all of you have done.
That is John Podesta, who a campaign chair for Hillary Clinton. And Ray Suarez, this not a concession speech at all. We didn't hear from the candidate. Kind of makes you wonder what's going on behind the scenes.
Leaving the door slightly ajar, surprisingly, given that Mrs. Clinton appears to be trailing in both the popular and electoral vote, leaving her very little room to claim that there's much to find out between now and when all the votes are counted.
He was not on the ballot tonight, of course, but President Obama put everything he had, as did his wife Michelle, into this election. His legacy on the line in many ways. Let's go now to Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent. And Scott, I don't think there's been a statement from the president that I've seen, but what are you hearing from the White House tonight?
Well, there has not been a statement from the White House, and we didn't necessarily expect one from them. We do expect to hear from the president maybe tomorrow or the day after. The irony here is that President Obama's approval ratings are at kind of a high water mark, except for his very first days in office. He's well above 50%. He's been drawing big crowds as he's gone around barnstorming for Hillary Clinton. And yet this is a stinging repudiation of his agenda, his legacy. And as a practical matter, Donald Trump and a friendly Republican Congress will have the ability now to undo so much of what Barack Obama has done over the last 8 years, including the long-awaited repeal of Obamacare, his signature health care initiative. You know, the only thing stopping the GOP Congress from undoing that law has been the president's veto pen, and presumably that would change with Donald Trump in the Oval Office.
Scott, Mrs. Clinton trails in Wisconsin and in Michigan. Pennsylvania and Ohio flipped to the Republicans, as did Florida. Did the president, in training his fire on these key states in the final days of the campaign, look like he had any coattails at all?
You know, the president spent so much of his time in North Carolina and in Florida. His very first rally with Hillary Clinton was in North Carolina, a state that he won in 2008 narrowly, and then narrowly lost 4 years later. And in Florida, neither of those were states that Hillary Clinton had to win. Both of them, they felt they had an opportunity to kind of put a kill shot on Donald Trump. And for all of the president's efforts, obviously Hillary Clinton lost both Florida and North Carolina. It's striking in Florida, too, because, you know, the based on the exit polls, we think the white share of the vote in Florida was down to 62%. If you had told somebody the white share of the vote in Florida is going to be 62%, I think they would have said at the outset, that's very, very good for Hillary Clinton.
And does that mean, does that mean then that the Latino vote was more complex than perhaps pollsters picked up?
It doesn't appear to be. No, the Latino vote was bigger than it was 4 years ago, and it went in roughly the same proportions as it did 4 years ago. It was not notably more hostile to Donald Trump than it had been to Mitt Romney, but it was certainly not more favorable. The real difference is that the margins among the white voters in Florida were much more favorable to Donald Trump than they'd been to Mitt Romney in 2012. Donald Trump did not so much find a hidden army of white supporters as he tilted the balance of white voters and really ran up the score with those who did go to the polls.
All right, Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent tonight. Thanks so much. Let's go now to New York and Tamara Keith, who has been covering the Clinton campaign for what probably seems like forever. Tamara, not the conclusion to a very long campaign that they were hoping for tonight.
Certainly not. I mean, they booked this venue with a giant glass ceiling, intending to metaphorically break it. And that didn't happen. And now people are filing out and they all look like they've been crying at some point in the night.
Yeah.
You know, one person I talked to who is a person inside the campaign said that he had cried several times in the last hour. And he said at this point, you know, he said that going into this, they felt like Donald Trump needed an inside straight to win. And now at the end of the night, they end with Hillary Clinton needing the exact same thing. And that's tough.
I'm wondering if maybe it's too soon for this, but is there any conversation about the FBI director, James Comey, and what happened just about a week and a half ago with her emails?
You know, I haven't heard that, though certainly supporters were angry about that for the entire 9 days that was hanging over the campaign. What I am hearing is that the campaign apparatus put a whole lot of faith in its analytics, and it made decisions about where to send the candidate, where to run ads, all of those things. It seemed like really smart decisions at the time based on their analytics. And it was just plain wrong. And
the,
so
the feedback from the polling, Tamara, would have convinced the campaign that they were making the right calls. It wasn't as if they were, you know, throwing blindly at a dartboard. All the information that was circulating in the political coverage world would have convinced them that the things that they were guessing on were right. When did they start to realize that the momentum was not in their favor?
Probably around the time Pennsylvania was called, or a little bit before that. They believed in their analytics. I mean, even before Wisconsin was called, I had someone inside the campaign texting me saying, you know, we just need Wisconsin and Michigan, and then, you know, there's still totally a path, and we believe that those numbers are going to come in from the urban areas. Like, they had their analytics. They used public. They used voter files. They had a system, and their system was sending them the wrong signals. And perhaps there's nothing they could have done because this was clearly a wave. This was clearly a change election. But certainly the things that they were doing that they thought were really smart things, fighting it out in battleground sections of Florida, now look like a miscalculation, that they should have been in Wisconsin.
Tamara, I'm wondering, of course, you know, it's never been done before, having a woman elected commander-in-chief, president of the United States. And again, this campaign, this election will be the stuff of books and college classes for many decades to come. But is there any discussion about, you know, what impact her gender may have had in this, in the outcome tonight?
Well, talking to some supporters here, they said that, you know, you never... It's never easy for women, and these were female supporters, this is the highest, hardest glass ceiling for a reason. And there certainly were gender dynamics throughout this race. Focus on her trustworthiness, things like that, obviously all of the signage at the Trump campaign rallies, the lock her up chants. There was, in addition to fueling a lot of other sort of divisive things, Donald Trump also helped fuel sexism through the way he ran his campaign.
All right, Tamara Keith tonight in New York with the Hillary Clinton campaign, ending, it appears, unsuccessfully. Tam, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Lisa Garcia Bedoya from UC Berkeley is with us as well. And what would you add to that, Lisa, the notion that it was a little tougher for Hillary Clinton because she was a woman, for one reason or another?
Well, I think for a lot of reasons. I think it's important to note that she lost white men by 30 points, again, if we believe the CNN exit polls, and she lost white women by 10 points. And so there is no sisterhood on top of race in this particular election. And so I think it's both how she was framed, I think the rhetoric that was used against her, and then the degree to which Trump was able to capitalize on it. I don't think it's by accident also that we're leaving the presidency of the first African-American ever elected to that office, and we have this tremendous backlash among white voters against Democrats and then against the first female candidate. So I think it was a complicated dynamic, but definitely sexism was a part of it.
Lisa, you heard Tamara Keith talk about the analytics that they used. Is there going to be a reckoning, an inside the business conversation about the reliance on these tools, which give you block by block views of the electorate and have been stunningly wrong, and tonight in a lot of places all at once?
God, I hope so. People who know me will know I've been arguing against these methods for a very long time. There are a number of things that are wrong with them, many to list, but the basic ones are that you're making assumptions about what the denominator is. You're making assumptions about what the electorate is, and you're also making assumption about what drives voters. And generally speaking, there is no real thought about how racial dynamics play out in the electorate among whites specifically. And so that is a problem. And then the other part that's a problem is that they build their models based upon past behavior. So they're depending upon the quality of the data, which is bad for certain voters. And then they're also assuming that past behavior predicts future behavior. And that's the problem, is that this was new behavior, and that's why they weren't able to capture it.
That is Lisa Garcia Bedoya from UC Berkeley talking with us tonight about the outcome of this election. Not quite yet a Donald Trump victory, but he is certainly on the verge of that. You're listening to live election night coverage from KQED and NPR News. I'm Scott Schaefer, along with Ray Suarez, and we are continuing our coverage of tonight's stunning election, both obviously across the West, still counting some votes here in California and other Western states, but Pennsylvania declared for Donald Trump. He is just a few electoral votes now away from that magic mark of 270. Pollster John Cohen, boy, your profession is going to be on the hot seat in the days ahead. What do you take away from what we've seen and are seeing tonight?
Well, it sure is, and we're still looking at the details, you know, so we have to dig in very hard. But on the surface, we may just be looking at a normal polling error. You know, if we remember back to 2012, when, you know, the average of the polls going in had Obama plus one, he ended up plus four, so a 3-point error on the margin. Clinton now is projected to have about a 1 percentage point lead in the popular vote. That could go up to 2 by the time all votes counted in California in the coming weeks. So we don't know if the difference is, you know, really that big nationally. Of course, that's irrelevant for the, you know, widespread prognostication of her, you know, kind of sweep in the Electoral College vote. So we have a lot to look into. I think the Lisa Garcia Bedoya talked about, you know, the racial dynamics. And I think that's what we have to take a lot of time to look at. When you look at the predictions of how the white vote would split, it was dramatically different than what the exit polls show tonight.
But, you know, there are national polls that try to look at the country from 35,000 feet. And then there are dozens of state-by-state polls. And in the last week before the polls began to open for Election Day, not for the early voting, we saw a convergence around a set of propositions about what this electorate was going to look like and what the final map was going to look like. And they were shockingly wrong.
In many cases, they were. But the maps weren't always wrong. I mean, we always had Hillary Clinton at 257. We had a top Michigan and Wisconsin as toss-ups, not solid parts of the Democratic blue wall. So there was variance in kind of the estimates out there. I think this is a bigger problem for the entire polling industry, as you mentioned. You know, when you get down to how high quality are we in these states? Are we getting the right composition? Are we adequately predicting the voters?
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, because I didn't see any maps from the big national polling outfits that had Clinton losing Florida and North Carolina and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin.
And barely winning Virginia.
Certainly true. So, I mean, in North Carolina and Pennsylvania are big misses, and those are the two that we missed as well. The others were toss-ups, and we, you know, kind of were too aggressive in thinking that she could win all of them, and when, in fact, errors, as many have pointed out, can be correlated. When you talk about a 2-point or 3-point error on the national margin, there was a sweep here. But I want to get at something that Donald Trump said, which was there was a shy, you know, Trump support out there, and there is some evidence for that.
All right, that's pollster John Cohen from KQED in San Francisco and NPR News. This is live election night coverage. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Stay with us.
It's so late, they've switched to the West Coast to do the NPR coverage, and Mike Mulcahy and I are here.
We're
in
still here.
Central Time in St. Paul, Minnesota, where we are waiting for a call here in Minnesota. To whom will the 10 electoral votes go? That is still, at this moment, undecided, Mike.
Right, and it's a tight race. Hillary Clinton now with about 35,000 votes over Donald Trump, with more than 2.3 million votes cast between the two of them.
Yeah.
91% of the precincts reporting, Clinton 47%, Trump 45%. Still waiting for some votes. But the really, really tight race, Tom, is in the first congressional district, where 94% of the precincts are reporting. And Tim Walz, the DFL incumbent congressman, has 50%. And Jim Hagedorn, his Republican opponent, has 50%. And they are separated now by 29 votes.
Wow.
Walz has a 29-vote lead.
Tim Walz was seeking his sixth term in the House, and it seems tonight, to analyze that just a bit, that there's a high number of Trump voters in that district who came out and put Jim Hagedorn within that, 29 votes of unseating an incumbent congressman, Tim Walz, in the district.
We're seeing Donald Trump run very strong in rural Minnesota, and that is a big part of this story tonight. And that's what Trump said he was going to do, and he's doing it.
And the other big part of the story, we do not have votes from Dakota County. We await those and results in the second district.
I'm Ray Suarez, NPR News, here at the San Francisco studios of KQED-FM. We continue our election night coverage. I'm joined by Scott Schaefer of KQED and by Ron Elving of NPR. Ron, welcome.
Good to be with you, Ray.
Ron, are we close to having a complete portrait of this election?
No, there will probably be some back and forth about the final counts with respect to Michigan and Wisconsin, possibly Pennsylvania as well. But at this juncture, it does seem clear that at least in the foreseeable hours, those states are not going to turn around and vote for Hillary Clinton. They all have a lead for Donald Trump in varying degrees, but most of the vote is in all three. And it is difficult to see how Hillary Clinton would pull the hat trick that she would need to pull to get all three of them back in her column, which is what she needs if she were going to get back on track towards 270.
Any idea why John Podesta took to the podium just a short time ago and did not say that it was over, that in effect they're waiting to see more information?
No specific idea, no specific fact that I could point to and say they are influenced by this knowledge or this data or this thing that the rest of us are not privy to. They seem to have some reason to think that the circumstances might still change, that there might be some way that these three states' deficits could be reversed. And mathematically, one cannot rule it out, but it is extraordinarily difficult to discern.
Ron, Scott Schaefer here. Donald Trump's success tonight is a repudiation, as it has been for the past year, his success, of the elite, the so-called elite in the Republican Party. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from people like Paul Ryan, who really kept his distance. Are we hearing any word from them, or is it just too soon? Are they waiting to see what the final results are?
Paul Ryan has congratulated Donald Trump, assuming that he would win, assuming that he would win in Paul Ryan's home state, and assuming that he will have the Electoral College votes that he needs to be elected president. Paul Ryan, in recent days, in the last 2 days, has said that he had voted for Donald Trump and has said that it was time for the party to coalesce behind Donald Trump as their nominee. Of course, as we know, in earlier weeks, particularly after the Access Hollywood videotape, Paul Ryan had refused to campaign with Trump, had canceled an event they were going to do jointly in Wisconsin, and had been as arm's length from his nominee as one can imagine the Speaker of the House being. But he would then say, my job is to make sure that the Republicans maintain the control of the House. And the way to do that is to get everybody out to vote. And the way we get everybody out to vote is to have them willing to vote for the nominee. So he was encouraging Republicans, urging Republicans in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And by the way, in Wisconsin, the Republicans have a very good ground game of their own based on Governor Scott Walker's operation. So they didn't need to worry as much about a Republican National Committee operation, although, of course, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Ryan Priebus, is also a Wisconsinite.
Ron, if we could run across the Capitol to the Senate side, two of the most relieved men in America might be the Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley and the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. They rolled the dice that they could get away with not confirming President Obama's Supreme Court pick, and it looks like that gamble paid off.
They did not even have hearings for Merrick Garland, the president's choice, and within hours of Antonin Scalia's death back in February, Mitch McConnell had announced that they would not consider any nominee from Barack Obama because, as he put it, the American people need to have their say about who the next Supreme Court justice ought to be, or at least about who should appoint that next Supreme Court justice, who the next president should be. A lot of folks said, ooh, that's pretty chancy, and polls showed, and I think we all have to stop for a moment and put little quotation marks around the words polls showed, but polls showed during the year that 60 or 70% of the people in the country thought it was wrong for the Republicans to stiff Merrick Garland and President Obama and refuse to consider this new appointee. Not even to have hearings, let alone an actual vote in committee or an actual vote on the floor. But what price did the Republicans pay for it? What Republican senator lost because of that? What evidence is there that the Republicans in any sense suffered for that refusal? I can't find any.
All right, Ron Elving tonight. Thanks so much. Still some votes to count and lots more analysis to come, I'm sure. Let's go now to Sarah McCammon, who has been following Donald Trump for many months. She is at the Hilton Ballroom with a Trump supporter. Sarah McCammon, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Looks like we're having a little bit of difficulty getting Sarah McCammon on the line. We'll continue to try to get to her. John Cohen.
I was just talking to Brett. I know.
We were talking earlier about polling and how the science of polling has changed. And I know that it has become much more difficult, for example, to get people to answer a landline. And more cell phones are in use, of course. So some polling firms have gone to the online surveys. Tell me, what impact do you think that's having on the quality of the polling, and could that be at all at play in what we've seen this election?
Well, we've thought for several decades that we've been on the precipice of a cataclysmic failure of polls, and we may see that, or we may see the simple polling error I described earlier. We just don't know yet. I mean, I think it's an opportunity to dig in and look. What we saw here was the online and telephone polls were equally wrong, nationally and in many of the states, as Ray pointed out. Some were different, and there's hope, but we have to dig in and make sure we're getting the right people.
Is there a phenomenon going on, do you think, perhaps, that, there was so much distrust on the Trump side and among Republicans of the media and pollsters? I mean, as recently as yesterday, Donald Trump was saying that the pollsters were making things up. Is there a way in which perhaps there were people wanting to mess with pollsters when they got called?
Well, potentially. I mean, I think we do rely, whether we contact people on the phone or online, that they tell us the truth. And the entire industry, kind of is on top of that. What we do see, is that there's some evidence that, white voters with college degrees, said something very different when asked by pollsters, whether on the phone or online, than they cast their votes at the ballot box.
All right. We're going to go now to Tim Clark, who is the California Trump campaign director. Tim Clark, joining us tonight from a celebration in Placer County, not too far from Gold Country and Sacramento. Tim Clark, you're almost there, but not quite.
That's right. We're almost here, not quite. Interestingly, listening to some of the conversations about polling and what went wrong with polling this cycle, I think that the pollsters were polling those people that normally vote three of the four or four of the four last elections, two of the last four. But we had over 20 phone banks in California, and we had people that had voted in zero of the last 20 manning those phones for Donald Trump, calling voters in battleground states. And we had people that had just become so disenfranchised that they're off the polling grid. And we had them in huge numbers in California. I'm sure they had them in huge numbers in Wisconsin and Michigan and some of these other states now that are surprising the pollsters.
They're known in the business as some of the hardest voters in the country to reach, people for whom voting is not a habit. How do you explain the apparent success that the Trump campaign had in turning out those very people?
Well, so from day one when I was hired out here in California, I always said, I don't have to motivate the Trump voter to vote. They're self-motivating. And I think that's the case in a lot of ways, too. Why did Donald Trump hold a series of rallies around the country? Because he was simply talking to those people that had become disenfranchised by the system. They're self-motivated. They wanted to vote this year. And here in California, we have over 100,000 volunteers. That's an unheard of number, over 100,000 volunteers. And when I got hired in April, these folks were already here and they were already active. And that's why when you hear it explained that this is a movement election and it's a movement campaign and all the momentum was with Trump, you look at some of these other metrics that maybe the pollsters weren't picking up, and you have to factor those things in.
Tim, I'm looking at the results rolling in here in California. Hillary Clinton has about 60% of the vote, Donald Trump getting about 35%. It's a romp for Hillary Clinton. Why do you think, what is it about California that is so out of sync with Republicans in other parts of the country? And I'm not talking about Kansas or Nebraska, but even Michigan or Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. Number one is we get about 1.5 to 2 million Democrat voters that show up in presidential years that don't show up in non-presidential years. But also for our campaign, we didn't walk a single precinct in California. We put our 100,000 volunteers to work in battleground states. We made over 1 million phone calls in the last 3 weeks, and a huge portion of those right into Wisconsin and Michigan, understanding that this was important. The narrative that the Donald Trump campaign didn't have a strong ground game was one that we were okay letting the media talk about, when in fact we knew quietly that we were very strong in the ground and very strong with our phones. So in California, we didn't spend any time here. We spent our time in the battlegrounds, extending our 100,000 volunteers into those regions where we knew that we, if we won those, that Donald Trump would be president.
Tim Clark, maybe you don't accept the narrative that was oft heard, as you mentioned, in the last couple of weeks, that Donald Trump had no ground game. But I'm wondering, as you talk about him and the campaign he ran, whether this is a one-off, whether he is a phenomenon, or whether he's rewritten the rules on how to run for president of the United States. He did things that no other candidate could imagine trying to get away with.
Yeah, that's true. We had one of the leanest campaign operations in my history. I've been in this business for 25 years, and our staff was very lean. Our operation was very lean. The campaign was built on these rallies, and certainly in the primary, he just set a different tone. I agree with that. I think it could be a one-off, or maybe it's just that we're at this point now where there's a majority of Americans are really dissatisfied with the direction the country's going, and this is how they've responded. They've elected an outsider to come in to the inside and try and fix what they perceive to be the problem.
Tim, this is highly speculative, and don't feel pressured to answer, but I've always wondered what a Donald Trump-Bernie Sanders election would have been like. Real quickly, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it would have been very colorful. This is an election unlike anything I've ever seen.
All right, Tim, I'm going to have to leave it there. We have to go to Domenico Montanaro at NPR.
Great. Thank you.
Domenico?
Hey there, guys. We have the breaking news here from the Associated Press that Donald Trump has now won Wisconsin. It is projecting and thereby goes over 270 electoral votes, and Donald Trump is elected president of the United States, the Associated Press projects. Now,
wow.
It's quite the moment, not one that any of us foresaw happening. The ability for Donald Trump's message of populism and protectionism, especially when it comes to trade, and appealing most importantly to those who feel disaffected by the system, by the political elites, has resonated more deeply than polls could pick up, more deeply than, and we picked up some of it in our reporting, but it was never quantitated, it was never proven out in polling. I should also say, if you step back for a second, that there's the possibility that Hillary Clinton winds up winning the popular vote based on the vote that's out in California remaining. Donald Trump is about a little over 1 million votes ahead of Hillary Clinton right now. And if she continues to win about 60% of the vote in California, and you have about a little more than 13 million people who come out from to the same margins of 2012, she'd be about 1.8 million. She'd gain net about 1.8 million, putting her slightly ahead of Donald Trump in the popular vote. So it's something to watch, but that doesn't matter. Our country elects presidents based on the Electoral College, and something that this country learned in 2000.
2000,
and,
absolutely.
And that is part of our electoral democracy,
Domenico,
and that is what's going to happen here.
Domenico, don't go away. Stay with us if you would. I'm going to bring in Sarah McCammon, who is at Trump headquarters in New York. Sarah, have they gotten word there that they worked for the president-elect?
I don't think so. I haven't heard the big cheer that I would expect, but the TV just flashed that, you know, Trump is going to speak soon to supporters, and people cheered. There's been a lot of cheering, a lot of chanting tonight. In fact, most of it jubilant and joyful, but also some boos directed at Hillary Clinton. Her picture popped up on the screen here a little while ago, and the crowd broke into chants of "lock her up," and then also that song you hear at sporting events, you know, the na-na-na-na, hey-hey-hey, goodbye. So there's a bit of gloating and also a lot of excitement.
Ron Elving, are you with us there also in Washington? I believe you are.
Yes, I am, Scott.
That antipathy toward not just Hillary, but the Clintons in general, was really strong. It was the unifying force for Donald Trump at a time early on after he sewed up the nomination that he didn't have on his own. What happens now, do you think, in terms of her? I mean, Donald Trump promised to have an investigation. The House promised to investigate the Clinton Foundation if she won. Does all that just go away, do you think?
Oh, we'll have to see. It will certainly not have the same urgency as a topic as it did as a prospect. The idea that the House would really want to occupy itself with such a pursuit is, you know, it certainly can't be ruled out. There are a lot of people in the House who still have a great deal of animosity towards the Clintons and would like to, in some sense or another, further their humiliation after tonight. But it also would perhaps seem a bit beyond the pale. It might seem to be a distraction from the nation's business for the House to do that when there was no prospect of the Clintons having any sort of political power ever again. So this unifying force that you mentioned, which was quite real even in the primaries, this was the one thing that bound all of the 17 Republican candidates for president together. Whenever they would have an acrimonious moment, somebody could say, well, at least everybody on this stage would be better than Hillary Clinton, then everyone would applaud and agree. And that was also true at the Republican convention in Cleveland. It was a way to bring people together whenever there was a moment of dissension. And it has been true throughout this fall, whenever Donald Trump might have done something that caused some of his Republican brethren and sisters to say, I'm no longer with Donald Trump, or I can't support him, or I'm holding him at arm's length, someone would stand up and say, ah, but that's just helping Hillary Clinton. And if you don't want the Clintons back in the White House, you're going to have to support our nominee.
He will have, Ron Elving, the wind at his back. This is Ray Suarez joining from San Francisco. He'll also have a Republican Senate once again and a long list of proposals. This has been a long campaign, and he's promised a lot of things, some that he can do on his own and many that he can't. He said, day one of my presidency of immigrants, they're getting out, and they're getting out fast. He promised to lower the corporate tax, end the estate tax, end the Affordable Care Act, end birthright citizenship, recognize Russia's possession of Crimea, lift sanctions on Russia. This is a big, bold, ambitious plan, much of which is opposed by elected Republicans on Capitol Hill.
In the past, yes. But whether they will continue to oppose it when it is the agenda of their own president is another question. Now, Obamacare, of course, the Affordable Care Act, they have already repealed and had that that repeal vetoed by President Obama. That's not going to happen again. Donald Trump will be more than glad to sign that. Will the Congress be willing to set aside the money to build a wall from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico? We'll have to wait and see if that actually happens. But if Donald Trump is going to insist on it, perhaps it will. And perhaps that deportation force that's been talked about will be a reality as well. Those are the kinds of things that we'll have to watch for January, February, March of 2017.
I want to bring Sarah McCammon back into our conversation at Trump headquarters in New York City. Sarah McCammon, tell us what's happening there. I know you said that Donald Trump was getting ready to come out. Does it look like that's imminent?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of activity here in the room, and it certainly seems that way. I don't have an exact time. I know the campaign told me about 15 minutes ago he was on his way, so probably not long.
Okay. I don't know if you heard that conversation that we just had with Ray, Ron Elving, talking about the agenda, the very ambitious agenda Donald Trump has laid out. Do you have any sense, from all the coverage of Trump's supporters you've done over the past several months, do they really think he's going to build a wall and that Mexico is going to pay for it? Do they really think he's going to end Obamacare and replace it with something that he never quite described? I mean, what do they expect, do you feel?
Yeah, I ask this question a lot. Usually I ask it more broadly. Just, you know, Trump has made a lot of promises. And he said it would be easy to fix a lot of problems he sees in the country. He says the problem is that there are, quote, stupid people in charge. And I often ask Trump supporters, you know, a lot of the challenges that we face as a country, economic challenges, challenges in getting health care for people, et cetera, they're complicated and difficult challenges. What makes you think that Donald Trump can step in and quickly solve them? And, you know, they say, well, he's a businessman. He has the kind of common sense experience, I think, in their minds to solve things. But then when I really press them and ask, you know, what if he doesn't do it all right away, most of them say that's fine, that they realize that things take time and that they'll still support him. Now, that's a big question, though. You know, when the rubber meets the road, when the reality of the political process and the challenges that go with it are seen, you know, what happens to this this movement that Trump calls it?
That's Sarah McCammon at Trump headquarters. Joining us once again, NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, this has the risk for Barack Obama of negating what he's just spent the last 8 years doing.
Absolutely, Ray. And that's one of the reasons that Barack Obama was campaigning so hard for Hillary Clinton. He obviously respected her, grew to be a friend after their own bitter primary battle. But he knew that his legacy would be in jeopardy if a Republican was in the Oval Office. And he said so repeatedly on the campaign trail. Everything is at stake. Just to take one example, the heart of the president's climate agenda is all built around executive orders and administrative actions. There's not a legislative underpinning for it. So with a Republican administration, you could easily undo, say, the power plant rules that are the cornerstone of that climate agenda. We've talked a little bit about Obamacare, rules governing overtime, rules governing the way investment portfolios are managed and the conflict of interest that some investment advisors have. Lots of actions that the current president's been forced to take administratively in the face of a hostile Republican Congress can be undone with the stroke of a pen by Donald Trump.
Let me bring in Lisa Garcia Bedoya from UC Berkeley. Lisa, this is fair to say a very bitter pill for women, number one, for immigrants, many of whom became citizens recently to vote in this election, some at least. What are your thoughts about immigration, the issue of immigration going forward, and how a Trump administration could begin to create a dialogue? Sometimes, you know, Nixon went to China. Sometimes could you foresee a way in which a President Trump might be able to get something done on immigration that Hillary Clinton couldn't with a Republican Congress?
I think that would be the case if it hadn't been such a centerpiece of his campaign. I find it difficult to see how he can save face with his supporters, given the hard line position he took, a harder line than many of the Republicans in Congress he's going to have to deal with, and talking about deportation forces, and then have a turnabout and do something different. So I'm deeply concerned about what this is going to mean for the day-to-day lives of the many unauthorized people who we have in our country. And I'm been trying to think through that. You know, will he suddenly say, like, we need to do something different? But I think it's difficult for him to do that. That said, he doesn't act like any politician ever, so it's possible that he won't feel hamstrung in that way and will feel able to do something different.
Do you feel, Lisa, that he got a lot of backlash when he started to suggest that maybe they could take a look at just deporting the criminals first and taking other ones on a case-by-case basis? There was a point, I'm going to say about 6 to 8 weeks ago, where he was starting to, in interviews, in public statements, soften what had been a very hard line earlier on in the campaign.
That was true, but I felt like he walked back from that a little bit as well and started, at least in his speeches, emphasizing the wall and not that part so much. And it's difficult to know, you know, given we have so little information about his supporters in terms of their positions and what they feel, if there was backlash. But I thought that, at least from what I read, that he had less positive response from his audience to that part of his agenda, and that's why he took it out of his speeches. So it's difficult to know what he thinks in terms of this issue, and it's possible that maybe, given the lack of policy content in general in his campaign, that having that softening wouldn't necessarily alienate the people who support him.
Well, day one of my presidency, they're getting out, and they're getting out fast, seems pretty categorical. Do you think that's where he is today?
it seems he moved away from that a little bit, but I think that's where his supporters are today. And so given that, I don't know. And there are many Republicans in Congress that feel that way and that feel like that there needs to be a criminal and draconian approach to immigrants. And so that is entirely reasonable that that will begin. And just the practicality, though, of it may keep it from happening because of the difficulties of carrying out the plans that he laid out from the beginning.
We're getting word that Donald Trump is now on the stage in New York, coming out with members of his family to a great deal of applause. He's walking. That is Mike Pence who's coming. We expect Donald Trump to be joining him any moment now. Mike Pence has been thought to be a very influential member of this administration, Ray. There was a point before he was offered the vice presidential nomination that Donald Trump called John Kasich and said, "How would you like to be the most powerful vice president ever?" Implying, I think, that he didn't really, Donald Trump planned to be a hands-on president. And so it does make you wonder who's going to be driving.
And Mike Pence was one of those people who was in all the lists of possible presidential candidates this time around. He didn't make the race, and now he's about to declare victory.
All right, here he is, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, Vice President-elect Mike Pence.
The American people have spoken, and the American people have elected their new champion. America has elected a new president, and it's almost hard for me to express the honor that I and my family feel that we will have the privilege to serve as your Vice President of the United States of America. I come to this moment, deeply humbled, grateful to God for his amazing grace. Grateful to my family, my wonderful wife, Karen, our son, Michael, and his fiancée, Sarah, our daughter, Audrey, far away, and our daughter, Charlotte. I could not be here without them. And I'm deeply grateful to the American people for placing their confidence in this team and giving us this opportunity to serve. And I'm mostly grateful to our president-elect, whose leadership and vision will make America great again. So let me say, it is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you the President-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
That's Indiana Governor Mike Pence introducing his boss, the man at the top of the ticket, Donald Trump, coming out to, sounds like, fanfare for the common man, or a variation thereof, followed by his wife and children now taking the stage. Mike Pence and his family, his wife and children, said he was grateful to Donald Trump for the chance to serve. He had said all along that this was a man of integrity. In return, Mike Pence helped deliver credibility among religious conservatives to Donald Trump, who, quite frankly, didn't have much of that. It hadn't been part of his wheelhouse. But now, here he is, the president-elect of the United States, ready to give, well, now the most important speech of his life. He's applauding. He's coming out with his family. The crowd is reacting, as you can hear.
Ray, you have to wonder if he really thought this moment would come when he got into the race those years ago. It almost felt at times like he just was building his brand. Some of the things he did were so not in keeping with what you do to get elected, and yet here he is.
He was the object of speculation about a presidential run in 2011, before the last cycle. And he publicly dithered about it. He gave interviews and then finally said he wasn't interested, but if he had chosen to run, he was sure he would have won. And at the time, a lot of people laughed. Well, this time around, he decided to run, and he's about to make a presidential victory speech.
So much of the commentary about him leading up to this moment is that he is temperamentally ill-suited to be president. Let's listen to what he has to say now that he is president-elect of the United States.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Sorry to keep you waiting. Complicated business. Complicated. Thank you very much. I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory. And I congratulated her and her family on a very, very hard-fought campaign. I mean, she fought very hard. Hillary has worked very long and very hard over a long period of time, and we owe her a major debt of gratitude for her service to our country. I mean that very sincerely. Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. Time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country. As I've said from the beginning, ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country and want a better, brighter future for themselves and for their family. It's a movement comprised of Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs who want and expect our government to serve the people, and serve the people it will. Working together, we will begin the urgent task of rebuilding our nation and renewing the American dream. I've spent my entire life in business looking at the untapped potential in projects and in people all over the world. That is now what I want to do for our country. Tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it. We will also finally take care of our great veterans who've been so loyal, and I've gotten to know so many over this 18-month journey. The time I've spent with them during this campaign has been among my greatest honors. Our veterans are incredible people. We will embark upon a project of national growth and renewal. I will harness the creative talents of our people, and we will call upon the best and brightest to leverage their tremendous talent for the benefit of all. It's going to happen. We have a great economic plan. We will double our growth and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world. At the same time, we will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us. We will be. We'll have great relationships. We expect to have great, great relationships. No dream is too big. No challenge is too great. Nothing we want for our future is beyond our reach. America will no longer settle for anything less than the best. We must reclaim our country's destiny and dream big and bold and daring. We have to do that. We're going to dream of things for our country and beautiful things and successful things once again. I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, all people and all other nations. We will seek common ground, not hostility, partnership, not conflict. And now I'd like to take this moment to thank some of the people who really helped me with this, what they are calling tonight, very, very historic victory. First, I want to thank my parents, who I know are looking down on me right now. Great people. I've learned so much from them. They were wonderful in every regard. I had truly great parents. I also want to thank my sisters, Marianne and Elizabeth, who are here with us tonight. And where are they? They're here someplace. They're very shy, actually. And my brother, Robert, my great friend. Where is Robert? Where is Robert? My brother, Robert. And they should all be on this stage, but that's okay. They are great. And also my late brother, Fred. Great guy. Fantastic guy. Fantastic family. I was very lucky. Great brothers, sisters, great, unbelievable parents. To Melania and Don. And Ivanka. And Eric. And Tiffany. And Baron. I love you and I thank you. And especially for putting up with all of those hours. This was tough. This was tough. This political stuff is nasty and it's tough. So I want to thank my family very much. Really fantastic. Thank you all. Thank you all. And Lara, unbelievable job. Unbelievable. Vanessa, thank you. Thank you very much. What a great group. You've all given me such incredible support, and I will tell you that we have a large group of people. You know, they kept saying we have a small staff. Not so small. Look at all the people that we have. Look at all of these people. And Kellyanne, and Chris, and Rudy, and Steve, and David. We have got tremendously talented people up here, and I want to tell you, it's been very, very special. I want to give a very special thanks to our former mayor, Rudy Giuliani. He's unbelievable. Unbelievable. He traveled with us, and he went through meetings. See that, Rudy? Never changes. Where's Rudy? Where is he? Rudy. Governor Chris Christie, folks, was unbelievable. Thank you, Chris. The first man, first senator, first major, major politician. Let me tell you, he is highly respected in Washington because he's as smart as you get. Senator Jeff Sessions. Where's Jeff? Great man. Another great man. Very tough competitor. He was not easy. He was not easy. Who was that? Is that the mayor that showed up? Is that Rudy? Oh, Rudy got up here. Another great man who has been really a friend to me. But I'll tell you, I got to know him as a competitor, because he was one of the folks that was negotiating to go against those Democrats. Dr. Ben Carson. Where's Ben? Where is Ben? And by the way, Mike Huckabee is here someplace, and he is fantastic. Mike and his family, Sarah, thank you very much. General Mike Flynn. Where is Mike? And General Kellogg. We have over 200 generals and admirals that have endorsed our campaign. And they're special people, and it's really an honor. We have 22 Congressional Medal of Honor recipients. We have just tremendous people. A very special person who, believe me, and, you know, I'd read reports that I wasn't getting along with him. I never had a bad second with him. He's an unbelievable star. He is, that's right, how did you possibly guess? So let me tell you about Reince. And I've said this. I said Reince, and I know it. I know it. Look at all his people over there. I know it. Reince is a superstar. But I said, they can't call you a superstar, Reince, unless we win. Because you can't be called a superstar like Secretariat. If Secretariat came in second, Secretariat would not have that big, beautiful bronze bust at the track at Belmont. But I'll tell you, Reince is really a star. And he is the hardest working guy. And in a certain way, I did this. Reince, come up here. Where is Reince? Get over here, Reince. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. It's about time you did this, Reince. Huh? My God. Yeah, say a few words. Oh, come on. Say something.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump. Thank you. It's been an honor. God bless. Thank God.
Amazing guy. Our partnership with the RNC was so important to the success and what we've done. So I also have to say I've gotten to know some incredible people, the Secret Service people. They're tough, and they're smart, and they're sharp, and I don't want to mess around with them, I can tell you. And when I want to go and wave to a big group of people, and they rip me down and put me back down to the seat, but they are fantastic people, so I want to thank the Secret Service. And law enforcement in New York City, they're here tonight. These are spectacular people, sometimes underappreciated, unfortunately, but we appreciate them. We know what they go through. So it's been what they call a historic event. But to be really historic, we have to do a great job. And I promise you that I will not let you down. We will do a great job. We will do a great job. I look very much forward to being your president. And hopefully at the end of 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or maybe even 8 years, you will say, so many of you worked so hard for us, but you will say that that was something that you were really were very proud to do. And And I can, thank you very much. And I can only say that while the campaign is over, our work on this movement is now really just beginning. We're going to get to work immediately for the American people. And we're going to be doing a job that hopefully you'll be so proud of your president. You'll be so proud. Again, it's my honor. It was an amazing evening. It's been an amazing two-year period. And I love this country. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you to Mike Pence. Thank you, everybody.